Welcome to the Roy Harper Podcast, episode number 25 for August 2009. My name's Paul Davison and I run the website www.stormcock.net. In this episode, we will have a brief news update, part two of an interview with Nigel Maslin-Jones, the A to Z of Harper, this time it's the letter X, listener feedback, a charity auction, and a selection of music. First of all, some news. Now, those of you of a certain age, possibly those of you that have been following Roy for a long time and have gone to gigs in the past, will know about the magazine Hors d'oeuvres, which was a Roy Harper fanzine that was out. I think the first issue came out in the early 80s, 83 or somewhere around there. And it was initially started by a guy called Pete Cunliffe, and that was later taken over by Dave Carlin and Darren Crisp. The magazine had all sorts of information for a Roy Harper fan, and later on in its lifetime, Nick Harper as well, as Nick started to emerge onto the live and recording scene. And it was really essential because we didn't have the internet, or not so much back in those days, and it was less easy to find out about gigs and get in touch with other fans and so on. Unfortunately, the magazine kind of fell by the wayside as the internet took off and Darren Crisp in particular got very busy as he was then managing Roy and dealing with merchandise and everything else. And I know that there are some listeners out there who have active subscriptions to Hors d'oeuvres still and are patiently waiting for the next magazine to arrive. Well, Pete Cunliffe has decided to do a kind of one-off extra edition, a 25th anniversary edition, if you will, of Hors d'oeuvres. And this time round, due to the joys of the internet, it's freely available as a download, as a PDF document, in fact. And it's 28 pages, actually, of photos, interviews, articles, and all kinds of stuff. It's about 50-50 Roy stuff and Nick stuff, and it's a must-see, especially as it's free. Currently, it's electronic only. If enough people nag Pete, maybe he'll look at doing a printed version. But for now, I've put a link to the download on the front page of stormcock.net. Or if you want to download it directly, see if you can make any sense of the URL as I read it out, which is www.saints-hosting.org.uk/sadfish/hdo(HDO)MED Should give out a prize for anybody that manages to write that down and actually do a successful download of the magazine anyway. Very impressed with what Pete's come up with. You can tell he's one of these graphics designer people who really has an eye for the sort of visual layout and impact of something. Really enjoyed reading it. So go and see that. Very good indeed. Thanks a lot, Pete. In less pleasant news, one long-standing subscriber to the Stormcock mailing list and occasional browser of the website, John Rees, unfortunately passed away a few weeks ago. I don't know too many details of the circumstance of his death. I just know about it because I got contacted, in fact, by somebody who's looking after his affairs, and I had the unpleasant duty of having to remove him from the mailing list and unsubscribe him from various things. And the guy also was interested in potential help with valuing some of John's rare items. I don't know, he had a Burn the World poster and possibly some bootlegs as well. So, rest in peace, John. Okay, now on to the main part of the programme. We'll start off with a bit of music. To lighten the mood slightly, I'm going to play Exercising Some Control from Folk Joke Opus, and then in the spirit of the current swine flu excitement, and I know for certain at least two Harper fans have gone down with it, being Lynn Branson and Andy Roberts. I think you're both getting over it now, or hope you are, but I'm sure there'll be more of us. I'm going to follow Exercising Some Control with the track Booper from Poems, Speeches, Thoughts and Doodles.
I got a dog, he's like a two-ton frog. I call him Some Control. Yesterday I took him for his walk, he's in the park, he's a beautiful thundering soul. At first he never took a fancy to anyone passing by, till a big fat cop came into his sights and he had to know the reason why. So he took his little piece out of the gentleman's leg, and the gentleman was so surprised. And limping up to me, he whispered quietly, "What are you playing at?" "I'm exercising some control," I said. "Exercising some control. Exercising some control." When I awoke, I gave myself a poke to make sure that I was still alive. I noticed I was standing in a courtroom with a judge, so I thought I'd better show him how to jive. As I was freaking out with me fancy, the judge said, "Give us a kiss." I said, "Oh dear, that's a little bit queer. I think I'll have to give this one a miss." But just as I was planning on a trip to the moon in me everlasting rubber john, he said, "Okay, Mutton Jeff, it's no good acting deaf. Find 20 quid, you creep, for exercising some control. Exercising some control. Exercising some control." Underneath the washing powder headlines, we'll meet at 9:10. You can do a clock dance on the top of my ship party. I don't care no more about exercising some control. Swimming in the tadpole bowl whilst drinking in the tadpole bowl. Leaking in the tadpole bowl. Exercising some control.
They used to fix my dingle at the clinic down the street when queuing on the NHS was easy. But now the queue's exuded by the sphincter of the state and slowly slides into Edwina's kazi. She's growing an umbilical from here to Morecambe Beach, where offspring lie around in bits and pieces, lurking on the tideline so that Sellafield can hatch new self-inflated breeds of tinpot feces. Men in moon suits come for them as soon as they progress to running at the mouth with superstition. Some are destined for the press, and some for Parliament, unable to avoid the recognition. I didn't think much of it all till I was on the beach and last night's meal came up in quite a hurry, and stood there in a stinking heap, delivering a speech reminiscent of Edwina Curry. The ambulance came racing down. I thought they'd come for me. I wouldn't have to queue. Oh, super duper. But they just hoovered up the puke and threw me in the sea. And then reconstituted her on Booper.
Now, just before we get on to the interview, I'd just like to say I think it's been a great success having a guest interviewer. John has done a brilliant job talking to Nigel. I'm really pleased with what he came up with. And I'd like to just say, if anybody fancies a go, maybe they know somebody that would be interesting to interview, or maybe they think they've got a particular skill as an interviewer or just want to give it a try, get in touch with me, please, because I'm quite keen to explore this a bit further. Really enjoyed it. And following on from there, I do have a list of people that I want to interview, and, you know, I work through it and see who's available and what's going on, etc. But I'm always interested in more people. So if you think you've got something to say, you want to talk about Roy or Nick or anything about the music scene and you think people might be interested, don't be shy. Get in touch with me, pd@stormcock.net, and we'll see what we can work out. It's a very relaxing thing to do, believe it or not, because it's not like a live show or anything. I can always edit out rubbish. Sometimes do. You might not believe that, but I do. And what we come up with normally is quite good fun. So if you fancy a go, again, get in touch with me and tell me what you've got in mind. Now, this is now part two of the two-part interview with Nigel Maslin-Jones, and I'll be talking a bit more about Nigel after the interview.
You made another couple of albums, late 70s, early 80s, Sentinel and Falls of the Finest Degree, and also Breaking Cover. That marked you working with Guy Evans from Van de Graaff Generator, drummer of Van de Graaff Generator, who a lot of people may know. There's an interesting story around how you're getting together with Guy.
Well, it was peculiar that the end of the 70s marked a kind of end of an era for many people, and the onset of the 80s became another era. I'd been pro for 8 years. I'd supported lots of people. I'd been asked to tour internationally across the European tours, which are 3.5 months, with Bartley James Harvest. And I suppose I'd had a lot of time on the road in that time to look at working with the top end of the business. It was very stressful. It was full of contradictions that I don't really want to trawl through here. But they were vicious contradictions, and I saw... It wasn't just on the Barclays tour. I'd been seeing quite famous people who were locked in, seemed to be locked inside a machine, often to the disadvantage of their creativity. It seemed that, I can't put my finger totally on it, it's almost as though they were working at such a level with such responsibility to large groups of people. I mean, on the road, when a national, international band's touring, you've got 30, 40 crew travelling for 3.5 months or whatever it is. And I kind of looked into the pit or the abyss of what was required and thought, I can see the crisis here is that if I keep going where I'm going, I might arrive where I thought I wanted to get, but I might have to sacrifice some stuff on the way. And really, by then, I was so ingrained into me working with a guitar and playing what I hoped was personable music to people often sitting only feet away from me, where it was beautiful atmospheres and gigs, that suddenly to be playing to 20,000 people, with the front row being 20 metres away from you, and a thin line of security guards between you and the audience. After 3 months of it, I realised that I probably wasn't going to be able to go down that route for very long. It didn't suit me as a solo person playing. I mean, Roy experienced touring with many people, and I think a lot of people solo who do this tour work feel the same, really. There are certain stages where it isn't suitable to put certain kinds of music, I don't think.
No, I mean, Roy certainly seems to put great stock by his refusal to compromise and play the game and make the singles and the videos or whatever that may have been required. And there's probably several other people in a similar boat. I mean, personally, I can't, you know, to play in front of 10 or 20,000 people with one acoustic guitar is very difficult to hold that
absolutely
atmosphere. And by and large, it isn't what people want. It's just simply by virtue of the fact that so many people want to see these people.
I think acoustic music of the sort that Roy or I play with a solo acoustic, it requires a personable communication with the audience beyond just playing the music.
Yeah.
There's a friendship. It's like a private sort of party gathering in a way. You know, there is some fun going forward. When I went to your party, John, with your friends, it ranks as one of the best gigs of my life. And not because of anything to do with technological things and staging or anything like that. It was to do with the vibe and the friendship and the place it was held in and the ethic it was held with. And it became like a party one won't forget.
Yeah. Well, nice plug there for the soul party. Yeah, well, that, I mean, as I said, that was our intention.
And you achieved it.
Yes, thankfully we've managed to get it. I mean, it's run by a couple of rank amateurs, but we've pulled it off.
We're all rank amateurs.
Doubtless we are.
I'm still practicing and rehearsing. I don't know what for. The great gig in the sky, probably.
Yes, frightening prospect. Okay, so that brings us through. Well, we never really talked about Guy.
I met Guy Evans from Vandergraaf Generator. It was very odd. Down here in Cornwall, there was one of the world's most renowned alternative fringe theatre people, groups called Footspan Theatre. Called Footspan because they rehearsed in Paul Foot, there's a commentator, author guy called Paul Foot, political figure. And this bunch of hippies, if you like, got together who were fine actors and actresses and became Footspan Theatre. They knew Guy Evans because Guy used to kind of live in and out of Cornwall quite often down at the southern part with a bunch of crazies down there. And Vandergraaf Generator had been touring the world and being as renowned as they were. And in, I think, 1979, just like myself, they got to a crossroads in their careers and decided to split up whilst they were at the top of their tree. When I worked with Barclays and I got off the road at the end of early 1980 in the spring, I also was feeling like it was time to strip off who I thought I was. If you like, I wanted to split myself up and reform. And I was down here kicking my heels, wondering what the hell, where was the next direction to keep me alive and fresh, to keep the music fresh. And thinking about what I'd experienced on the road at that level, and did I want to do it anymore or whatever. And this Footspan Theatre had met with Guy, recorded some music in a barn in Devon, asked me if I could do some mixing on my recording equipment. Could they borrow some equipment for this bloke called Guy Evans? I went up and met him, but we suddenly realised that we were both players. After we'd done this mixing thing for this theatre group, we had some jam sessions in the hall, realised we really liked playing with each other, and that's how it started in 1980. By 1981, I'd got this album out called Breaking Cover. The title gives you a clue. I felt like a hare in a field breaking cover from where I'd lived and from where I'd always been, and I was heading off in a different direction. Guy is a fantastic percussionist, powerful drummer, a very even-handed person to work with. He doesn't work with his ego, he works with his music. And it was just so refreshing to meet a powerful musician who was right inside what he did, who hadn't got all those ego edges of being some kind of star, you know. And we're the best of life friends for a long time now as a result of that. We go out and only do probably one festival at the moment a year, because we've done a lot of the fringe festivals. We did a lot of festivals in that very early 80s period. We went to lots of them. It's where I met Nick Turner from Hawkwind. I managed to get Guy and Nick on the same stage at the Tree Fair in the late 80s in Forrester Dean. In fact, we've got some recordings with Guy and Nick, and also on Glastonbury main stage, when I featured a six-piece band with Guy Evans, and Nick was playing on Glastonbury site, and I said, hey, Nick, come and jam with us. So that we've got three or four recordings where Nick crops up on the various albums, but there's one specific album that I put together in 97 on Voiceprint Records, now deleted, but still you can get downloads on the web. ithinkmusic.com, it's called, I Think Music. And we put the deleted album, it's called Live with Guy Evans, Nick Turner and Friends, and it's excerpts recorded at places like the Tree Fair in the Forest of Dean, Stonehenge, Glastonbury, things like playing the chill out set for the Whirligig Dance People, because that's another thing that it led on to the rave stuff that started in the 90s. Well, of course, one of the first raves was Whirligig, who, instead of using thump computer music, were using really good danceable ethnic music from world roots. But they had lovely chill-out sets where they'd bring the parachute out at 2 o'clock in the morning and 1,000 people chill out, and you're required to play live improvisational, gentle, textural music for an hour. Very nice. So we've got excerpts of that, and I put it out on an album because I thought, well, they were lovely moments, you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll play some music from that live album.
Never to be repeated moments, and we managed to compile some onto the album eventually. So.
Okay. Well, we'll listen to a track from that.
See you next year. God bless. Bye-bye. For Nick Turner on sax, Guy Evans on kit and percussion, Joe on violin, Angus on recorders.
To bring in the Roy connection here. You worked with Roy on his Once album in, came out in 1990.
Yes, it's well titled. I only ever saw Roy play live once. And I only ever worked with him on one album once. And the album was called Once.
But I think, you know, musically, and certainly in terms of probably where you come from, even going back to the Beatnik thing, you obviously have a lot in common with Roy, certainly in terms of you're perceived to be very much in the same genre, I would guess.
I suppose so. I mean, he's a bit older than me, and he had the benefit of being in central London, knocking about with the folk club scene that was in central London, whilst I was in the provinces as a younger lad, knocking about in the provincial folk scene, and not really that comfortable or knowledgeable about being in central London. I mean, I often look back and think, well, life isn't predictable or fair. But as far as exposure to people recognising names or music that goes with it, if you weren't in central London doing regular work in all those gigs like the Half Moon at Putney and the Troubadour and the 12 Bar Club, if you weren't a regular face, you weren't going to really get recognised on any kind of national circuit. My recognition came, the little bit of recognition I got came from when I was touring, supporting the likes of Judy Zook or playing at the festivals, and I suppose eventually working with Barclay James.
Any reflections on your time working with Roy?
Yeah, when I worked with Roy, I stayed in his house up in, I think it was Norfolk, for a week. It was called Folkingham, the village, which I found highly amusing. I never asked him why he decided to move to a place called Folkingham. But it was a lovely house, and he'd got his studio in there, and we just got heads down and got on with it, really. We worked quite hard. He had some songs planned that he wanted to have a look at, see if I fitted in with. But also, some stuff came up on the fly, so to speak. That's what happens when you're in creative mode. Stuff happens, and you've got to be prepared to notice that stuff has just happened and follow it up. I don't know what the name of the track is, but there's a very interesting spoken track that's a kind of sound collage on there. But it uses that well-known tribute to those who've fallen in battle. And you know the one I mean? We shall remember them.
Yes.
He uses that poetry, and it's in a creative texture. I suppose his lady at the time, Jackie, was aware that I'd been up to that kind of textural, experimental stuff with Guy, using the spoken word as an edge foil against music and sound. That was by bumping into Guy, really, because Guy introduced me to the idea of extemporized, improvised, catching the moment on the fly, and it didn't have to be a song that lasted 3 minutes, if you know what I mean. And that's what I think Roy was looking for from me, and I think that that's what he managed to get from me in that week. But I did see him at the Skinner's Bottom Festival. It was a folk festival down in Cornwall near Truro, and I'm not sure of the year. For some reason, I ended up on the same stage. I don't know why. And I do remember that both of us were quite enjoying ourselves, should we put it like that, and I do seem to remember a bit of fun we've had. I mean, it was funny, while I was at Roy's, I did say to him, one of my favourite, we were sitting having a bit of nosh at one point, and I said, I didn't push him about his own music or hustle him, I just happened to mention that I absolutely loved the album Valentine. It's the one with Roy drawn in pencil, and his heart is on his sleeve, and the pencil drawing of him, his own hand is rubbing himself out. And he actually sort of turned on me and sort of quite vehemently said, I hate that album! And it wouldn't expose. I did reflect and thought, well, of course it's called Valentine, and I probably touched a slightly emotional edge there without thinking it through. I just love the songs on there.
Yes, as I'm sure a lot of people do.
They're very beautiful melodically.
Yes.
His heart is on his sleeve. He's very open and fragile, a bit like Nick Drake, if you know what I mean.
That, yes.
That lovely, honest openness of heart. Yeah. And perhaps I'd just remind you, I suppose if I'd done something where I got an album like that, I could probably be a bit twitchy about it 10 years down the road, you know. Because it probably involved love with people that he's no longer with, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So I suppose the more personal a song does get, the more vulnerable you might be to disliking it later.
Yes, you know, yes, it comes back to haunt you almost, isn't it? Kind of like the John Martin Grace and Danger stuff, which is, you know, essentially an album of his going through his divorce and the breakdown of his marriage. And
well, I have to say, I absolutely loved John Martin to pieces when I was in my late teenage years. The first couple of albums were my favourite, Road to Ruin and stuff.
Yeah.
That was with Beverly, wasn't it?
Yes.
But I started to really quite dislike the dark side that started to creep in the later years. And I did kind of love Solid Air album where he started to get quite dark, but I've come to quite dislike it because of that dark energy. And since John has passed away, and I've become an older person, you do hear how things were progressing for people like John, and it was sad to hear the stories that we heard as fellow musicians. And as wonderful a musician as a person might become, there's always a life story going in parallel with it as well.
Oh.
And I made a choice way back in my early 20s when I first, for instance, I'll explain this like this. I once found myself smoking some Afghanistan Black when I was very young. I think my first time I ever bumped into it. At someone's flat in the middle of winter on the Stourbridge Ring Road with a force 10 gale going on. I hadn't had anything to eat. The dope was incredibly strong. The flat was really dire and dour and damp, and everybody in it seemed a bit out of it. And they were playing some Jimi Hendrix album over and over and over again. And I just remember running out into the night thinking, the world is full of darkness. I don't want to be here. And it was a bit like that when I heard some of Led Zeppelin's stuff. And I just, being a Midlander, I kind of knew a little bit. You picked up stories about Midlands bands, and of course Led Zeppelin had quite a heavy Midlands contingency in the band, as did Black Sabbath, and there was an energy about keeping things the right side of the line of light, if that makes any sense. And it used to worry me that musicians, very powerful players and writers, seem to also live half their lives, or even more, way over on the dark side, for want of a better word. And I know it has its place, but it wasn't a route that I was comfortable with.
And no.
It wasn't a route that I ever... This is probably a spiritual discussion that I can't really have with any accuracy, because I don't know my stuff. It's purely intuitive gut level that I'm going on about here.
Yes, well, no, I mean, it has to be about that reaction, doesn't it? It doesn't get any darker than Black Sabbath.
It used to worry me. I also, because I was a player... I knew that music influenced people, for goodness sake. I knew how much it had influenced me.
Yeah.
And I knew as I grew older and was playing to people, as I got feedback from all, I mean, yeah, I've become a lifelong friends with people that I've met who were in the audience at a gig, John. I'm godparent to a mate's son, and I met him and his wife at a gig. Mm. You with me?
Yes.
Gigging is never been and never will be just about a gig for me. It's about the people you meet when you're there and en route, you know. And there was just something about, if I want to do this for a long time, I get the feeling there are certain aspects of this career and lifestyle that I've got to be really careful not to trip up over. And that's about substance abuse or alcohol abuse, physical abuse when you push your body to the limit, driving for 14 hours a day to do a gig, night after night for 3.5 months, you know. In 1980, I drove 27,000 miles on the Barclay James Harvest Tour in my own Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Played to about 500,000 people. Was on the road for 3.5 months. And I lost quite a lot of myself in that time, if that makes any sense. And I saw a lot of dark aspects to life, as you do when you travel that amount of miles. And I started to realise that I was right to stick to my obscure route of staying on the right side of this line between light and dark, if that makes sense.
Yes,
I suspected I might live longer.
I doubtless you made the right choice.
And I was suspected that my creativity would probably stay with me longer. There was something, I was suspicious that maybe, I don't know about karma, I can't say yes or no to the law of karma. I do see it at work on a day-to-day, year-to-year basis, you know, on a street level, but I do wonder about it, and I made my choice, and I'll stay with it, you know.
Yeah. But given that you are still very much doing the music thing, what's coming up next? What else is, what's on the horizon?
Well, I've had a lot of experiences since the Camelford water poisoning in 1988. It was like lifting the lid off a Pandora's box and looking into how this country doesn't work, I'll put it like that.
Yeah.
The dialogue with government from local level right through to national level has gone on since 1988. It's involved a lot of legality, environmental awareness, the story has moved forwards, science and medicine has moved forwards, freedom of information has moved forwards. It affected my life big time and radically, and I couldn't turn and run when the event happened under my own nose. For the listeners, it was basically that a poor old lorry driver, it wasn't his fault, but he dumped 20 tons of aluminium sulfate directly into the water treatment plant, which got fed to a population of 20,000 people across North Cornwall and 18,000 tourists. It didn't affect the majority of people, but it did affect those nearest to the treatment plant. So it affected a few thousand people, of which a few hundred were affected deeply and radically, of which many who were elderly went to their graves rather quicker than sooner than later. And to this day there are arguments over whether it did or didn't, but it coincided with the awful privatisation of the water companies in 1988. The water minister at the time was Michael Howard, QC. The Freedom of Information Act years down the line showed us that he took advice from civil servants who told him that under no circumstances were any of us to be ever allowed a public inquiry into the incident, because it would have completely scuppered the water privatisation and would have cost the Chancellor of the Exchequer £4.5 billion, which in 1988 was a tenth of the national turnover budget at the time. So we were hung out to dry. Right now, this year, 20 years later, we're waiting for the two pending coroner's inquests into two elderly people who had the foresight to insist that when they passed on, they had autopsies done, which have shown the largest amounts of aluminium ever found in human bodies in Britain. These coroner's inquests are being held at bay by various government, well, not government, it's the Department of Health. Various shenanigans are going on, refusal to release information and stuff. The coroner's inquests will be this year. Then there will be a lot of truth come out. So I can't say too much about it, but I couldn't turn and run. But it did kind of scupper me concentrating on my career since the early 90s. But I'm now around a bit full circle, if you like. I've done a few albums, various projects, like the Angels Over Water album, which is instrumental and very calming. I did the live album in 97 with Guy Evans and Nick Turner. And I produced which I prefer, my best album, in my opinion, is an album called Behind the Stone, which is all the songs that fans nagged me to put on disc through the 90s. So that was my last acoustic album was in the year 2000, called Behind the Stone, and that was my last acoustic project, because then Planet for Sale was the BBC program that became an album, which came out last year. But that's totally non-acoustic. Took a lot of years to sort it out with guests like Steve Hillage and Banco de Gaia. It's very in-your-face, non-acoustic. Trancy, dancey is the way I would describe it. It's certainly intense, and I'm trying to set up a charity project with it. If it ever goes into profit, the profits will go towards eco-charities or charities that I know of who are trying to help people in places in the world. There's a charity called Shelter Box that send fully equipped boxes to equip a family of 12 in disaster zones. It's complete with water tablets and tent and toys for the children and teaching aids. And there's been thousands of them shipped out all over the world. Each one costs 650 quid, and it's all it'll help about 12 people live in shelter. It's double skin tents. They've gone to the Himalayas and the earthquake zones and Africa and all sorts of places. So I'm hoping the Planet for Sale album, which is about the planet being for bloody sale, I'm hoping to make some money eventually down the line to help out that particular shelter charity.
Planet for Sale in need of renovation. Who'll give us tuppence for this dead old globe? Who'll breathe a little life into a dying nation? Who'll give a little love to the sick and the old? Why is the bloody rich so bloody greedy? Why is the government so corrupt right to the core? Let me know, sister, when the party's over. Let me know the moment so we can take the oars. Turn the rich over, let's see what they are hiding. Turn the lot over. Under the stone, the greedy rich old bastards have stolen all the jewelry. They've even up the roof from off my bloody home. They're so busy buying shares in Mother Nature, busy getting rich while the poor can go to hell, spouting equality, the mother of parliaments. A rule of law and business has given the hard sell. Travellers or minorities, no room anymore for the starving or the poor. And I watch the little crumbs fall off the polished table, leave all the work to charity while the plebs eat off the floor. And it needs a change of thinking if we're to go on living, bringing up our children on this planet green and blue. It needs a change of living to keep the garden beautiful. We're only the caretakers, we're only passing. Who'll give us tuppence for a dead old globe? Who'll breathe a little life into a dying nation? Who'll give a little love to the sick and the old?
But it has led me round to thinking I really want to be doing much more acoustic stuff. That's been itching at me for years now, so I've got a lot of acoustic material that's built up. I've recorded 3 or 4 songs that are towards the next acoustic album, very simple. And I've kind of gone back to my roots in a way, because when the first 2 albums were re-released, I had to trawl my archives looking for new material. I had to wade through all the old recordings of what I used to do. And it was quite a shock to hear. I got quite a buzz out of listening to the early recordings of just a raw 12-string recorded with very little equipment. And processing, but nevertheless huge, beautiful 12-string sound. So I was a bit inspired by that, and it reminded me that at my core issue is that I love playing acoustic 12 and 6-string guitar. I love instrumental work. I've never done a really sparse acoustic album, and I kind of am challenging myself to do exactly that.
I shall look forward to hearing that.
A seriously very few overdubs, very few guest players, very sparse, very acoustic, and I do like writing what I call on the hoof. A lot of musicians, including Roy, they know exactly how this works, that you suddenly, for some reason, some songs occasionally just write themselves. it just comes pouring out. And if you get it down on some kind of tape so you can capture how it is, then get in the studio and do it nicely before it gets old and worn out.
Yeah.
I'm after some very upfront instant stuff, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, interesting.
If I listen to early Nick Drake, or early John Martin, or early Roy Harper, or even early me, I always hear this beautiful, very open... I'm struggling for words. It's to do with youth itself, and I know I'm not young anymore, but I can connect heavily, instantly, with how I used to feel in certain moments, in certain moods. And it really all got highlighted when I trawled through my early recordings for the re-releases of my first two albums in the last couple of years. And it might be that which has pointed me at, I really want to do some very sparse acoustic guitar recording. I'm heading towards that now. I'm just be refitting the studio, and I'm hoping to start work on that. Well, I'm actually hoping to start working the next couple of weeks on it. I've already been putting quite a few notes down on small tape.
Excellent.
So I'm kind of heading there. I don't know how long it'll take to finish. Maybe the winter.
Yeah.
Maybe it's ready for next spring. I also am very keen to do another Planet for Sale album, because Planet for Sale actual album is only 10% of the finished material that was recorded for Planet.
For regular listeners of the podcast, Paul Davison usually runs the interviews, and he always insists on asking everybody this, what's become now sort of Paul's favourite question about where you see the record industry, music industry going with live gigs, the cost of gigs, the downloads, CD sales, etc. Interesting perspective potentially you have, Nigel, having, as we said, always been independent, and certainly now with the internet, obviously you've got the mail order store on the internet, and now you've got some of the deleted albums up as downloads. Any thoughts on where you see that the industry or the upcoming trends in music?
I think it's a continuation of the revolution I've seen going on since I first got involved in it in my 20s. It has never stopped changing. I think the web and computing has been a revolution. I think when it hit 24-bit a few years ago and you could actually record analog instruments really well, everything's to play for. I mean, I think there's been a complete... It's a bit like there was a desert and somebody spilled a watering can on it and a million things are flowering. And I think we're in the middle of a million things flowering. And examples of that is the explosion of popularization of world roots music through the late 80s into the 90s. That not only exploded music around the world roots, it brought a lot of national boundaries crashing down as far as the common person was concerned. I think it was also very educating to have the national boundaries being pulled down. And I think a lot of people learn a lot of things about everyone else on the planet through listening to different music. So I'm very optimistic that just like always, there is a revolution of music. The music is created by people, and they will always make it no matter what the circumstances. Even if they're outside a mud hut with a carved out clamshell and a gourd, eventually... The way this globe is shrinking, the way we can travel around it either virtually in reality or in physical form, we're all much more aware of a lot more things. And it's as though music has been, in fact, not just music, but all the art forms, they all intuitively reach out to connect with other art forms. And naturally, it's people creating it. So people naturally reach out to create and mix with other people. It's when their different art forms inspire each other.
Yeah.
But I think that computing gives access to sound much quicker. It gives access to communication between people much quicker. And the live gigs will always be necessary because there's an old saying, it's centuries old, for festivals. Life without a festival is a road without an inn. There will always be people getting gatherings together to be entertained and to entertain each other. And the corporate world, the ones that see profit on the back of entertainment, who've always been there, right, for centuries, there will always be these different levels. So I'm very excited. The actual industry, I see the same world financial battle and exposure of the corruptive influences of corporate greed being completely echoed within the entertainment industry. Because the entertainment industry, as far as Britain's exports go, is a huge part of Britain's income.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I see the corporate manipulation. We all see it. We all see the reaction by each generation coming up to it to say, well, screw you, I'm going to do my own thing. And, of course, these days you can. So it's happening on, it's going on many different levels, and I don't think you'll ever stop the root creative process. You just won't. You can't. It's part of human nature. And it always comes from the ground upwards. And really, what was yesterday's profitable corporate is today's hanging on by a nail owned by Sony International.
Yeah.
I mean, there are only a couple of labels left on the...
Well, there's only two or three majors. And then you've got, down to the bedroom people and the MySpace and the...
And they're running scared, the corporates, because they're used to it. But just like the King's Boot of Clothes with the government and our revelations over Parliament and expenses, we had revelations this winter over the state of corporate greed internationally. Before that, a few years, we had revelations over the non-sustainability of communism. I see all these isms as falling on their arse. I think they're right in the middle of the revolution. I think music and entertainment might get knocked about on the corporate level, but it will only ever, ever get healthier on the street level.
Yes, I'm great. Well, that's got to be a good thing, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's the people's music. Yes, all right, it might get to the point where it's hugely popular and selling and making a fortune and needs a machine. You do need some kind of business machine teamwork to make stuff happen on the level it gets to internationally. And good people will come and go. What I love is the fact that you can break something out into public awareness without having to go through the corporate chain. Though I must say the same kind of ethics have started to be applied by so-called independent bands on the internet. Well, actually, they're not really. They've got a couple of people full-time on making sure that they get a million friends on MySpace as part of their marketing tool. Well,
If you want to call it a system, whatever is the norm, then people will work it to their advantage, I'm sure.
It's always been a great dilemma for the musician. I can't speak for artists, but within the musical fraternity, I know an awful lot of people who still to this day and will forever, even the youngsters coming up, they will always struggle with the contradiction and dilemma internally between what their heart and their creative brain is doing and what their intellectual, practical, linear, mathematical, money-headed brain is telling them to do.
Yeah.
If you can get through the razzmatazz of being young and famous and get out the other end still creative and physically, mentally, emotionally, creatively intact, you're doing really well. And I think the only way to do that is to not be hammering your music 7 days a week, year in, year out. I think you have to live your life and do lots of interesting peripheral activities if you want to write anything of any consequence. You can't just write songs about being a person who writes songs.
All right. Thanks, Nigel. Well, I think that's probably a good place to leave.
You asked me to give you some website plugs.
Nigel, do you want to tell us about what you've got, the new website, and where people can buy stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've been running a website for many years called Isle of Light, which is based on the Isle of Light label and stuff. But recently decided, a year ago, that I'm kind of up for not making things difficult. So I've got a site now called NigelMaslinJones.com. Both the sites have got links to the web shop for CDs and stuff. But we've also started to develop this really good download music site that's run by music people with ethics. and it's much higher quality downloads than most people offer. And it's run by musicians for musicians, really, and it's called ithinkmusic.com.
That's great. Well, thanks for your time, Nigel. Some very interesting conversations there. We could have done this all night, I'm sure, but...
It's been really good to talk to you, John.
Yes, well, thanks for that, and all the best with the new album.
Excellent. I'd just like to say, as we seem to be on Roy's website here, to say all the best wishes to Roy. I haven't seen him since... I bumped into him at the reformation of the Van de Graaff Generators' first ever reformed concert at the... A couple of years ago, Van de Graaff.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't play... He doesn't tour at all now, really. He's allegedly making a new album. But
I didn't know Roy... Is Roy retired, then?
He's retired from touring. He's now actually said he's retiring from live performances. I think he intends to try and do a smaller number of... selective venues, but he said he's not going to really play live until he's got the new album out. He's a bit he's gone to ground in Ireland at the moment, but we the Roy fans wait with bated breath.
Well, I sort of had to go to ground a bit in 92 with all the water poisoning stuff, but I have managed to detach myself from being sucked under by it. It's taken a long time, but I'm now back to being... I really seriously am looking on to getting stuck into acoustic guitars in front of my mics in the new studio that I've set up.
Yep, great.
So, exciting times, we hope.
All right. We'll wrap it up there, Nigel. Thanks for time, and thanks for giving us your thoughts on the podcast.
Pleasure, John.
Cheers.
Okay.
So, once again, thank you very much to both John and Nigel for that interview. Really good stuff. Now, I've spoken to Nigel a little bit since we did the interview, and he's a really lovely fella, and he's trying to get back into the music side again after various diversions, and I'm going to give him what little help I can in helping out with bits and pieces. And I picked up some of his recordings. You've heard some of the tracks... here, the Sentinel and Fools of the Finest Degree stuff, and Ship to Shore, and Planet for Sale. I've got all of those now, and really fantastic, very much worth getting into. And I know from some of the feedback I've had from people after the first podcast that it's awakened a lot of people's interest in Nigel, either those that have heard him in the past and lost touch with him, or those that are coming to it brand new. He's really worth looking into, and hopefully he'll be out gigging at some point and we can meet him in person. Wonderful stuff. Thank you once again, Nigel. Now, Nigel sent me a whole bunch of links, including all sorts of stuff from YouTube with live renditions and the actual Planet for Sale video and all kinds of other stuff, and far too many to list in an audio fashion, but I'm going to put them all in the show notes, and that should give you lots of fun going through those as the next month progresses. Now it's time for an audio track again, and I'm going to play Blackpool, and this is the version from the Live at Les Cousins album. I was listening to that this morning and I thought, actually, Roy does a fantastic job with a very tricky guitar piece, although he's somewhat self-deprecating about it at the end. So, Blackpool from Live at Les Cousins. Thank you.
like a diamond's pinpricks the still water, spread eagles its laughter. Across the green sheets of the sleeping sea.
Exceptionally kind tonight. That was quite bad, but never mind. No, it wasn't. It was all right.
Relax.
Yeah, this is a song.
So that was Blackpool from Live at Liz Cousins. That album actually is really quiet. I had to do a bit of audio fiddling just then to actually get the guitar sound up loud enough, and then of course I had to dramatically ramp down the audience applause level, otherwise everything would get distorted. So there's a candidate for a remastering project if the opportunity ever arises, because it's a really nice live album. Now on to the A to Z of Harper, and it's the letter X, and I have had over the past couple of years a number of people who have said, ha, what are you going to do when you get to X, eh? Including Roy, in fact, when I interviewed him last year. And he actually suggested that he record a special 5-second new Roy Harper track for me, which basically involved him playing one power chord and the lyric would be X. Unfortunately, that track didn't come to light, so I've gone back to plan A, which was to talk about X-rated. And here I'm talking about the cover art for the Flashes from the Archives of Oblivion album, which, as you may know, features Roy sat down on the floor with his trousers off and his hand manipulating a part of his body with a big black spot over the graphic. And in the lyric book he says, the sleeve art caused a kerfuffle in the EMI factory at Hayes, Middlesex. Like all sleeve art at the time, it came in layers. The top layer was the script, the one underneath was the spot over my genitalia, and the bottom layer was the photo in all its glory. When the women saw the erection, they downed tools and threatened a strike. There was obviously some consternation over rations. I would obviously have to visit. And there's not much you can say about that other than to say I'm going to play Don't You Grieve from Flashes from the Archives of Oblivion.
I was the master's best friend, he was the only man I knew. Minotaur harvest that he turned us all on to. But my lips are sealed by history and my tale I cannot tell. My name is a Jude Iscariot, my home address is hell. So baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't you grieve after me. Baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't you grieve after me. Baby, don't you grieve after me. It was just gone midnight when he called me to his side. He said, hey Jude, I need you, boy, I need you to take a ride. I want you to tell those guys downtown that my time's long overdue. Wait a minute, Jude, you don't stick around, cause nobody's gonna kiss you.
nobody's gonna kiss you. And baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't you grieve after me. And baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't you grieve after me. And baby, don't you grieve. You got all the silver and no forgiveness in your hearts, and I've got 20 feet of rope to end just where your guessing game starts. I got endless books to write you, but my tale I cannot tell. It's the only way you'd ever hear me is if you're living in the same hell, if you're living in the same hell. So baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't grieve after me. Baby, don't you grieve after me. No, 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 don't you grieve after me. Baby, don't you grieve after me.
Now for some listener feedback, and not too much to actually read out verbatim this time, but Nigel's interview and his music in particular has gone down very well with people in general. One or two people perhaps thought that having a different voice on the interview was a good or a bad thing. I've had mixed reports on that. Somebody missed me. That's very, very nice. Had some ideas about names of Roy Beer, Bitter Roy, or Tom Tiddler, or Tom's Tiddle from Keith Bedford there. Keith sent me another email and said that good old ex-pirate DJ Roger Day gave Roy another play last Friday evening on BBC local radio across the south. I can claim the credit for this one as I requested it, and I attached Roger's intro. He sent me an MP3 and I will play it for you.
Why is it, I always think of that old radio station, Laser 558, whenever I... That was their theme tune, wasn't it? Wonderful station. Do you remember how exciting it was when it came on? Because most of the radio stations on the air at the time were really boring. Hey, no change there then. And this American thing came on the boat again. And even though it had no publicity and everything, everywhere you went, everyone was listening to it, even though it was only on AM. It just goes to prove that it doesn't matter what it's on, as long as the format's good, people will listen. What do I know about it? Anyway, that's Happy Memories, ABBA, and thank you for the music. And this is Roy Harper. I've been meaning to play this for weeks. This is Keith, aging anorak in Basingstoke. Not wrong with that, lads. This is when an old cricketer leaves the crease for Freddie Flintoff. Excellent. And that is Roy Harper, and an old cricketer leaves the crease. We like that.
Nice one, Keith. Thanks for that. Now, one other bit of feedback was from Kenny Wisdom. He says, I thought it was a great interview and I'm really looking forward to part two. I have to admit to not knowing much about Nigel Maslin Jones at all, and I hadn't gone out of my way in the past to find out much more about him, but after this interview I'm going to check out some more of his wonderful music. I thought the inclusion of this interview was totally relevant and a fantastic chronicle of the festival scene, which kept it on point with Roy and his past career, in my opinion. It was a free festival where I first saw him. On another note, I'm a recent convert to the iPod and iTunes. It's blooming marvellous how the podcast pops up in my little player every month. I don't think I want to know about your little player, Kenny. I get the same rush waiting for each new episode as I used to every Wednesday waiting for my Beano to arrive. Okay, I'm not going to start doing a Dennis the Menace serial to try and compete with the Beano, but it's very gratifying to hear that, Kenny. And for those of you that haven't yet done subscriptions to the podcast, if you're just downloading it manually from the website every month, you can actually subscribe via a feed. If you use iTunes to play music or fill your iPod or whatever, you can find the Roy Harper podcast in the iTunes store. click on podcast and do a search for Roy Harper, and it'll pop up along with some other bizarre stuff that's got nothing to do with Roy. And if you use other podcatchers or RSS aggregators, you can find a subscribe link on stormcock.net. If all of that sounded like complete gibberish to you, don't panic about it. You can carry on downloading it directly from the website. Now, I've had an email from Colin. I think your surname's Coates Colin, but it may not be. Apologies if I've got that wrong. Colin posted to the stormcock.net forums, actually, and said, I recently got given a copy of Beyond the Door as a birthday present, but already have it. Bought on Roy's tour in 07. I'd like to sell it. It's new, unplayed, but not sealed. Drop me an email at keltcoates@btinternet.com. Now, I wouldn't normally do sort of commercial adverts, but what Colin's suggesting to do is to send whatever money he gets from selling this DVD to Nick's charity, the cancer charity that we've already talked about last month, which is a really good gesture, actually. So what I've suggested with Colin is that if you're interested in donating to Nick's charity, Love, Hope, Strength, and haven't already, why not suggest to Colin a donation? I think we're talking about a minimum of a tenner, basically, but if you, say, want to donate 20 quid to Love, Hope, Strength, why not send Colin an email and say, look, I'm bidding 20 quid, and if you're the highest bidder, then you'll get the DVD, and he'll pass your money on to Love, Hope, Strength. Seems like a good option to me. We'll set a closing date of the August bank holiday. So if you're interested in Roy's DVD and you haven't got one yet, and you fancy giving the money to charity, perfect opportunity. I'll put Colin's address in the podcast show notes, but again, it's Keltcoates, keltcoates@btinternet.com. He'll probably ask you to, depending on where you are in the world, give him money for postage as well, which is only fair, isn't it? So yeah, get on with that anyway. Now, some credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited, and the Nigel Maslin Jones music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Isle of Light Records, and in both cases is not for copying or redistribution. If you want to help the podcast, you can go onto iTunes and post a review of us, which would be very nice. You can make a PayPal donation from the link on stormcock.net. And if you want to send some feedback, you can post it to the forums, send me an email, or you could leave a voicemail, which I really like getting. Send me an MP3, pd@stormcock.net. Or if you can't handle MP3s, just pick up a telephone and call in. If you're in the UK, 01223 850 282, or outside the UK, +44 1223 850 282. That'd be really good. I had a very weird email, well, not weird, just unexpected, a few weeks ago from a company that wanted to sponsor this podcast. So obviously I've started to hit the big time now. And it was basically a guaranteed monthly amount of money that they would give me in return for, they were offering to host the podcast and do some advertising for me. But also, of course, I would have to plug a product or a series of products on the podcast on their behalf. Now, this podcast has never been about commercial aspects, and as a result, I've declined. Otherwise, right now, I would be going on about a fantastic domain hosting company. But I'm sorry, that's just not my style. It amused me intensely, however, and I thought it might amuse you as well. But no, we're not going to be running adverts on here unless anybody has a joke advert they'd like to send in. That'd be good, wouldn't it? Anyway, that's about it for this month. And we'll finish off, since we've got a little bit of time, with the track Winds of Change from Once. Hope you enjoy August. See you next month. Bye for now.
Tearing your people's ideas into a shred. Jack.